I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Lo Effecto. She's director of New Mexico Arts, and we are here to talk about the Governor's Arts Awards, and there is an event tonight. We are joined here in the cafe by artist Tony Abeta, and on the telephone by photographer Michael Berman. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Great to be here.
So, Loie, what are the Governor's Arts Awards all about?
Well, these awards were started by former Governor Bruce King and Alice King, the former First Lady, and it really is New Mexico's highest and most prestigious arts awards. And this year, tonight, we are presenting awards to seven New Mexico artists and art supporters, including the two exciting gentlemen you have on your show with me right now, and also Lonnie Klein of Las Cruces for music, Ed Sandoval, a renowned painter from Taos for painting, Thomas Catron III of Santa Fe, major contributor to the arts, and also other major contributors are the J.F. Maddox Foundation of Hobbs. They do a lot with kids and arts education down in southern New Mexico. And then Catherine Oppenheimer here in Santa Fe. I think a lot of your listeners are going to be familiar with National Dance Institute, and also she was the driving force behind the New Mexico School for the Arts, our first charter high school for the arts.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a big event, a big night, and amazing people. And we thought we would take this opportunity to actually talk to some of the folks and find out what they're doing. Michael Berman, we've had you on the air before talking about your work and some of the books you've done. You make photographs kind of on the border of Mexico and New Mexico, and I find it fascinating that you come from a background where you actually studied biology and ecosystems, so your photographs are coming to a large extent from that place. Is that correct?
You know, I have come to think of the arts and the sciences as kind of an equivalent, and they were a long time ago, where we're really trying to use symbols to understand things that are sometimes beyond language and a little more complex. So I did get a degree in science, and the God, that seems like a long time ago. It was in college. And I had a wonderful teacher, Jim Anderson, who worked with peregrine falcons, and it was the beginning of the Endangered Species Act, and it was one of the first endangered species both to be worked with and also to be successfully brought back from the brink of extinction. So I have this background in biology, but I really always kind of loved looking at things. And so I ended up figuring out that as a scientist, I didn't get to spend as much time outside looking at things. So I ended up starting to photograph and realized, other than getting paid for it, is a great way to justify walking around and wandering and looking at the land.
Now, is that how you make the photographs? I mean, you wander around and kind of let the landscape speak to you?
You know, in some ways, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But then as I've gotten older, I realize is that often I won't photograph in a place until I've literally either lived there or walked it or been there for at least 10 years. So there is this larger cycle of becoming acquainted and familiar with the landscape before I begin to make photographs. And I really think that looking, that initial period, is the most important part, because one of the things, you know, part of our culture right now and the larger world culture is that we spend less and less time in a landscape. And even people who do usually have a very singular perspective, and just the ability to walk around and not have an agenda and just sort of dwell in the wonder. It's really kind of amazing out there. So the work always starts there. And then at some point in time, I do have to sort of engage to the larger world and do other things. And then I begin to make photographs. So it has these two ways of approaching it.
10 years is a really long lead time. I mean, I was thinking about people who come to a place and write about it, or come to a place and paint it or photograph it. There's a really different kind of style that a newcomer or understanding that a newcomer has than somebody who's been there for a while. But 10 years is a really, really long time to be in one place without photographing it.
You know, I've lived in New Mexico since 1990, and that's when I moved here. And, you know, my intent has always been to photograph the Gila, and I didn't start that work until literally, you know, 2 years ago. You know, on occasion, I'd make some pictures, but really engaging it fully was something that just seemed time. And often what happens to me, it's not a great cycle, but I'll go someplace and really feel I shouldn't photograph, and then it seems like it's time. And often within a short time after I finish photographing, there's radical changes in the environment. And that's been pretty consistent. I was working in the Chihuahuan Desert the last 7, 8, 9 years, and much of that, especially in Mexico, has transformed into farms. And the same thing in the Sonoran Desert and the borderlands, all that has gotten caught up. Literally a landscape you could spend 3 weeks in without seeing another person has sort of now become a kind of, if you can forgive me, a playground for the Border Patrol. And it really has radically altered a very, very healthy ecosystem. So it doesn't seem that long. In the bigger phase of things, 10 years is really a short period of time to look at something.
Now, you say that when it feels right for you to photograph, usually that means that something else is going to happen later. Do you intuit that, or are there signs? Or,
you know, it's fully a sort of... Sometimes things come together that I'm looking for something, but often it is fully intuitional. And I think the Sonoran work was where I discovered that, is that I went out to the Cabeza Prieta and also to the Gran Desierto, and I, for a long time, just had this really strong sense I shouldn't photograph. And, you know, the rational part of my mind, the science part, was saying, this is crazy. This is what you do. You should make pictures. And I didn't for about 5 or 6 years. And when I finally started to, a lot of things came together, including, you know, meeting Chuck Bowden, who, you know, we worked on a book together. And it seemed there was a real serendipity that he understood the work, because he had that similar thing of really spending some time learning about something before you actually, you know, make statements. So it makes sense to, you know, it's not what our culture does now. I mean, generally speaking, often photographers, you have 2 weeks. You go out, you make photographs, and you make a declaration on what's there. And it makes sense also to do it the other way, where you dwell in a place for some time.
I was looking at a lot of your photographs before our conversation over the last few days, and it really struck me that not only is photography a language of its own, the way music is a language of its own, but the land itself that you are photographing kind of has its own language. And for the person to kind of learn that and to understand it and to respond to it is something that takes a while and is very hard actually to put into words.
You know, it's fully a sort of, sometimes things come together that I'm looking for something, but often it is fully intuitional. And I think the Sonoran work was where I discovered that, is that I went out to the Cabeza Prieta and also to the Gran Desierto. And I, for a long time, just had this really strong sense I shouldn't photograph. And, you know, the rational part of my mind, the science part, was saying, this is crazy. This is what you do. You should make pictures. And I didn't for about 5 or 6 years. And when I finally started to, a lot of things came together, including, you know, meeting Chuck Bowden, who, you know, we worked on a book together. And it seemed there was a real serendipity that he understood the work, because he had that similar thing of really spending some time learning about something before you actually, you know, make statements. So it makes sense to... you know, it's not what our culture does now. I mean, generally speaking, often photographers, you have 2 weeks. You go out, you make photographs, and you make a declaration on what's there. And it makes sense also to do it the other way, where you dwell in a place for some time. So
it's interesting, too, because as I was looking, some of the photographs that I was looking at didn't even have titles on them for whatever reason. I just couldn't find the titles, or I just looking at images. And I thought, boy, I really would like to know the story behind each one of these pictures. In other words, I would love it if you would describe where it was, how you got there, what this means to you. But I guess that's not what you're up to.
You know, it is and it isn't. Is that you got part of it? Is that, you know, often in the West you could, you know, title your photographs Cottonwood Canyon, you know, Cottonwood Tree. We have these things that repeat, but one of the things about my work, and I know often when I come out, so, you know, out from being in the land for a few years working on a project, I begin to talk with curators and people in the art world is that each of the photographs does have these long sort of stories or how they relate to landscapes or history or places or ecosystems. And what I find is that I'm actually someone who can't write, but I love talking. So it's this real strange thing of even language. There's a real difference between storytelling and relaying something in words physically than there is in writing things down. And again, I think when you talk, you can bounce around and it disappears. Whereas once you write things down, it has a certain weight that is really quite different. And I love that ephemeral nature of reality and somehow the photograph contrasting that where you make it still, but it really never is still. So those stories are there, and they're in each photograph, but it would take a lot of time to tell them, so I just have the pictures.
Now, you always work in large format, black and white?
I have mostly worked in large format. The Gila work I just did, I did in medium format, and right now I'm sort of fooling around with digital cameras. I'm not sure what will come of it, but I still do shoot with the large format, and I love what the camera does. In the end, it forces you to make less pictures, but also as I get older, carrying a big old view camera and water and, you know, stuff to stay outside is starting to get a little beyond me. I'm not very big. I'm about 130 pounds, so carrying, you know, 45, 50 pounds and just walking around is getting a little hard to do, so.
Yeah. Well, I want to congratulate you on winning the Governor's Arts Awards. That's a nice honor for somebody who's done so much in New Mexico.
Well, thank you very much. It's really quite wonderful.
Let's turn now to Tony Abeta. He is a painter. Well, primarily you're a painter. You've worked in all kinds of media over your life. Welcome.
Hey, good to be here. Yeah, I have. I'm predominantly defined as a painter, contemporary Native American painter, but I've done sculpture, and for about 3 years I did jewelry. But I retreated back to painting as my main inspiring muse. That's actually what I'm doing on a daily basis. Most of my shows are now really geared around oil paintings.
It's interesting. You just mentioned you sort of defined yourself as a Native American painter, American Indian painter. I can't remember the exact words you used, but that's it's on the one hand a definition. On the other hand, it's kind of a box that people would put you in. How do you feel about that?
Well, people take different approaches. I think there's a lot of people who say I'm an artist first, and then I happen to be Native American. I've certainly heard that one. But for me, it's a perfectly valid definition. I mean, I do appreciate the opportunity to be a Native American and to be an artist, and those things seem to go, you know, enmeshed hand in hand. I really feel like it's been, you know, what defines me, and I paint a lot of different things. There's a lot of range in what I do, everything from modernist landscapes to Native American deity paintings to very abstract black and white works on paper. And so for me, all of it comes from a very vital source, that being, you know, mostly defined in Native American iconography and mythology and personal experience.
One thing that I find so interesting is when people, whoever it is, I mean, you know, you look at Renaissance painting and people were doing iconic religious paintings and people were doing mythological paintings. And I've always wondered, if you could go back and ask those artists what that really meant to them, I would wondered what they say. And what does it mean to you to do that mythological kind of work in a modern era?
Sure. I think if you went back, you could see the stimulus was mainly faith-based religions for a lot of it. I mean, if you went to look at Italian Renaissance paintings, so much of that was based on, you know, their passion and devotion for painting saints and painting ceilings and heavenly beings.
So, but they also had a pretty serious client.
Yeah, they had clients always. I mean, that's part of how things work. It's, you know, we actually do need collectors and clients alike to be able to keep doing what I do for what I do. You know, to keep my rent paid and certainly to, you know, get my work out to be seen. You know, it goes in the gallery, but eventually it goes into homes and people see it there too. So it's a I think a very good system has worked that well for me. But yeah, I think the question about, you know, if you could go back and see, you know, what inspired the people, what inspired artists in particular, it was, I think most of it was, you know, something, the passion that they had for what they were painting. And that's, you know, for me, it's about what I'm passionate about feeling and the experiences. It's certainly about experimentation. It always has been. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in school and traveling, and I bring home all these different little vignettes and experiences from my parts of life. Like, I'm sitting on a cliff on a Saturday afternoon looking out and saying, man, it's so beautiful. It's immense. I want to take that home and paint it. And it's an emotional response to the landscape, different than some other people who take photographs and work from the photograph. I take back an experience, an emotional response to that, and then I want to paint that and get a feeling of what it felt like. Like, how does it feel where, you know, how can you paint, you know, smell, the scent of rain? How do you describe the sounds, the thunder? You know, how do you get the drama? And that's important to me as a painter. And the same way with the deity works for me, that kind of native iconography, I look at, you know, what is the rhythm? You know, is there a musical cantation that is present in the work? And is there also, how does the color respond and describe a cultural, you know, community? And so part of it, I believe it's just wonderful. You know, I like being a conduit, and I channel all this great, great information, and then I create stuff that never existed before. So it's like this really exciting thing. I can look at a painting and say, wow, am I completely responsible for seeing that painting done? It really came from a lot of different experiences, and that's really the great part of what I find is my passion. That's my passion for making and creating images.
Now, you've mentioned the music and rhythm that goes with some of the iconic paintings that you do. Why is that? Is because the images come from ceremonies where there's also this rhythmic and musical element, or?
Well, I think it's in a lot of things. I mean, I could describe my painting, but art in general, I think there's this almost very universal rhythm that happens with dance, and it happens with music, and it certainly happens with art. And when you hit it right on cue, it becomes apparent, and people recognize that. It's like this just sort of, you know, on a deeper cellular level, we find this place where art is recognizable on the deepest of levels. And we either recognize it as being something, you know, authentic, valid, and true, or sometimes we have to dismiss it because there's so many artists in the world. So certainly being able to get recognition for what I do is like, wow, this is great. That I'm hoping people sense when they look at my work, they're finding that rhythm, that very kind of unseen language that I find present in other art. When I see it, I'm like, that's it. That's beautiful. That's amazing. I see it in, when you read certain things and you're wild poetry and you're like, this is so beautiful, the way the words all work together in unison and they spell out something, you know, language, you know, Michael was talking about earlier. And when I listen to him talk, you can hear the certain, you know, the confidence in the words that he has, that he puts together, and it forms his ideas clearly, succinctly, and it's what I look for in my work as a painter. I try to get clarity. It's crisp, it should be clear, and it should be, you know, inspired.
Now, you were born and raised in Gallup, New Mexico. Do you feel like that? I mean, and you've traveled so many places and studied art all over the world and all over the United States. And so what is New Mexico? How do you find New Mexico or your New Mexicanness in your art now?
Well, I was born like around, you know, red cliffs and mesas and sagebrush and, you know, beautiful sunsets and all of that. And translating that to a new place when I moved to Santa Fe, it was very much the same, but I got a little different kind of color palette, and it became, you know, it's either you're a New Mexican and you just really understand it and you really feel like there's really no other place, and that's how we call places home, is there's a familiar element that is present. And so for me, it's like it's pure inspiration, especially for the landscape material. When I'm painting landscapes, I'm looking at the cloud formations as I'm driving, racing to the airport to go to Los Angeles or New York, and I'm looking, and I know I'm leaving New Mexico, and they're so recognizable. They're so much part of this vernacular. I'm not going to see them the same way when I get to New York. It's a little hazier and a little bit much more Payne's gray. And when I'm out here, I see this just incredibly vital, rhythms, and I see, you know, shapes and forms, and it's amazing to bear witness to all of this. I try to document that, capture it in my mind, shoot quick digitals on my phone, get back to the studio, pull it up and say, okay, this is what I'm painting. This is all based on a memory that I had a week ago when I was on my way to the airport.
I was going to say, when you were saying that some people work from photographs, how do you notate the things you want to remember?
Oh, well, it seems kind of silly, but I will look and I kind of draw the landscapes with my finger, just like in thin air. So I kind of catch the way a mesa falls, that kind of slope and the speed of that line. And I sort of do a quick fake drawing on, you know, just with
your hand in the air.
Just, yeah. Sometimes people think it's kind of weird. Like, I'll be sitting there looking at something like I'm painting, you know, this really weird thing. And somehow my mind documents that very experience.
I wonder if it's a muscle, like muscle to brain translation or something?
Yeah, I think so.
I
do really weird things with the fingers in my hands. If I have to remember something, most people put in their iPhone calendar. I just take a marker and I write it on my hand and I look and I'm like, yeah, I've got an interview at 2:00. And so I do that, but I also spend a lot of time just looking at the, there's a certain familiar aspect to the landscape, for example, the light, the intensity, the deep blues. I try to capture and document all those colors, and I take them back and I echo those immediately. There's a lot of invention that goes on in the work when I'm back there, because I'm more interested. I'm not interested in documenting how some place really looks. Like, if you had to paint the Grand Canyon, you know, you have to edit things. You have to edit, you know, everything from, and in many cases in New Mexico, you have to edit telephone poles and, you know, old cars, or not.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But for me, I have to focus on what I'm really trying to get is the emotional response to what I'm painting.
Well, congratulations to you too, Tony Abeta, for winning the Governor's Arts Award this year.
Yeah, well, thanks. That's a great honor. I'm really pleased. It's an exciting night.
Now, Loie Fecto, once again, Director of New Mexico Arts, it must be quite a process to select the recipients every year.
It takes about a full year, actually, to put this event on, and at the end of the year, we start seeking nominations from the public. Anyone is eligible to submit nominations, unless, of course, you're an employee of the Department of Cultural Affairs like I am. And then we have a subcommittee, the Arts Commission, meets and makes recommendations, and ultimately, it's the Governor's Arts Award, so it's the governor who decides. And this year, Governor Susana Martinez will present these awards tonight, which is very exciting. It's preceded by an event, an exhibit opening at the Governor's Gallery. That's on the fourth floor of our state capitol.
And everybody's work will be shown, Tony and Michael and everybody else?
Exactly. And all we'll have displays of all seven awardees. That opens at 3:30. It runs until 4:30. And then the Governor Susana Martinez and our Department of Cultural Affairs Secretary Veronica Gonzalez will be at the awards ceremony later tonight, which begins at 5:15 at St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. And I was really struck listening to both Tony and Michael talk. I mean, I think about our arts and our tradition of arts and culture in New Mexico, and it really, to me, is what makes New Mexico, New Mexico. I mean, our artists, the way they interpret our beautiful landscape and turn images into poetry and all these different disciplines, I just think it's a real defining part of our state, and it's a huge economic engine for us and a big cultural tourism driver, too.
Well, Loie Fecto, I want to thank you very much for being here, and artist Tony Abeta, photographer Michael Berman, and Michael, we'll have you back maybe next month when your book comes out.
That would be great. That would be fabulous. I look forward to it.
Well, good. Well, thank you all three for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Great
thank
to be
you.
Here.
Oh, and also, I'd be remiss, since we're talking about Arts Awards, it's not the Governor's Arts Awards, but Mary Charlotte, congratulations on getting a Mayor's Award this year from the City of Santa Fe.
Thank you.
Nobody is more deserving, and this show just rocks, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great honor and privilege to have artists and creative people on my show on a regular basis. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Jeffrey Haas. He's a civil rights attorney, an author, and human rights advocate. And tomorrow night, he will be giving a talk along with Santa Fe and Becca Wolf. It's called Demographic Engineering, Israeli Displacement of Palestinians from East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And that's happening Saturday night at the Unitarian Church here in Santa Fe at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So you were just there. You were in Israel. You were in the occupied territories.
That's correct. My son Justin and I went, and we were there for about 2 weeks in July and August.
And what motivated you to go in the first place?
Well, I've been concerned about the treatment of the Palestinians, and also I'd never been to Israel or the West Bank. And so I thought I would go and take a look and see what I saw. So my
You've never been to Israel?
I'd never been to Israel, no.
So what did you see?
Well, what I saw was pretty distressful to me, pretty depressing. And I did focus a lot on how the Palestinians were treated. I spent substantial time in East Jerusalem, in some of the West Bank cities of Hebron and Bethlehem, and some of the West Bank communities like Beit Omar. I also visited many of the Israeli tourist sites. But what we saw is a very systematic way of displacing Palestinians from the land. And I'll begin with one of the first things we learned is about water. And, of course, water is critical. So we had a really interesting presentation, and then we saw how that played itself out. But one of the things, contrary to common belief, there's quite a lot of water in Israel and the occupied territories. Between rainfall, which is substantial other than the summer, and two large aquifers in the Jordan River, there's plenty of water to go around. The problem is about 88% of it is taken by the Israelis. The Jordan River is completely drained and used for the Israeli agricultural and other use. The aquifers under the West Bank, under the settlements in many cases, are taken by the settlements. So they have water for gardens, for fields, and for washing. And then there's an aquifer that runs along the Mediterranean coast, which ends up in Gaza, but most of the water is drained out before it actually gets to Gaza. So now the aquifer in Gaza, not only being contaminated by the bombing, when Israel invaded, but it's being depleted and will likely collapse within about 5 years.
Now, what percentage of the area that we're talking about, Israel and the occupied territories, is made up of Palestinian people?
Well, it's less and less. What we saw was a very well-organized campaign to basically drive the Palestinians away from Jerusalem, away from East Jerusalem, away from most of the areas of the West Bank, and to contain them in about four or five cities of the West Bank.
So there's not fewer people. They're just being concentrated in a ever-shrinking area?
Pretty much. The Palestinian resistance, as they say, existence is resistance. And we asked one Palestinian, what's your desire? And he said, it's to die in my own house. So in spite of these incredible conditions, the Palestinians are trying to find ways to survive, supporting each other, building community organizations, and so forth. So yes, it's more and more Palestinians live in less land and in much worse conditions. We visited the village of Beit Omar, which is actually quite a prosperous village, not too far from Jerusalem. The people had very lush fields, grew plums and pears. And one farmer said, well, my annual income was about $40,000 a year. Then a large settlement of Indian Jews was put on part of their land.
From India.
Now, here was a Palestinian man telling me, that's the house where my father and grandfather were born. These people have been in this village for hundreds of years. And yet a group of Indian settlers came. Then they were supported by the IDF. Now they have a substantial settlement, and they're taking over more and more of the territory of Beit Omar, burning down olive trees, in some cases attacking the Palestinians, and basically Israeli settlers have immunity. if they attack Palestinians, they're never charged with a crime. So we see even what had been prosperous Palestinian villages shrinking in size, getting less and less water, and their crops, they can't get to the Jerusalem to sell them because of the checkpoints. So life is getting worse and worse for Palestinians, although they are surviving in numbers. The form of life that they're forced to live under is pretty terrible.
So, Jeff Haas, just looking at the numbers here, you do have a country, or, I mean, it is one state, it's Israel, which is, in terms of population, 50% Jewish, 50% Palestinian.
Right, pretty much. If you add up the Palestinians in Israel proper, in the West Bank, and in Gaza, the population is very close to the Jewish population of Israel.
But if you actually look at the map, it's a tiny percentage of Israel, which is now Palestinian territory, and ever shrinking.
And ever shrinking. Let me just explain one other how it's shrinking. Israel has done some things that are very clever. I would actually call them diabolical. The area of East Jerusalem, which is mainly Palestinian, has been declared open land or parkland. That means in order to add on to your house, you need a permit. But the permits are controlled by Israelis, by Jewish people of Israel. So a Palestinian in East Jerusalem can't get permission to add a room onto his house. If he or she does, then they are subject to, if he or she builds without an order or without a permit, they're subject to demolition. And as far as I know, Israel is the only country in the world that demolishes houses for building without a permit. And that might seem, well, what's so strange about that? Well, I lived in Chicago, and if you added a porch or a bathroom onto your house without a permit, they'd come and they'd fine you, and maybe they'd make you comply. They never tore your house down. But that's what they do to Palestinians who build without permits. And you can't build in East Jerusalem because you can't get a permit if you're a Palestinian. Similarly, 60% of the West Bank, what they call Area C, has been declared agricultural land. So if you're a Palestinian and you want to expand your village, you can't because you need a permit because it's agricultural land. But if you're a settlement, if you're a group of settlers who put a trailer or a group of houses there, you get permits to build. So basically, there's no law that says Palestinians can't add on. They're just the way the laws are enforced prevents Palestinians from building in East Jerusalem or in the most of the West Bank.
We're talking to Jeff Haas. So this is a situation that's been going on for a long time, year after year. We talk about it on this program. A lot of people around the world, I mean, there's tremendous international support for Palestinian people. Why does it just keep on going on as if no one were watching?
I think because the U.S. backs up Israel militarily, economically, and diplomatically. So that every time, I mean, you know, the U.N. has had a declaration about the West Bank and the occupied territories and a peace treaty for how many years, how many times has that been passed, and there's no enforcement of it. And any time another Israeli law gets enacted that's in violation of the UN treaty, the U.S. blocks any kind of UN action against it. So what's happened is that Israel has the money and the financial support of the U.S. and to some extent Europe against the Palestinians who don't have much support among the leaders in the Arab world. They have a lot of support among the people in the Arab world.
So you and your son were in Israel, Jewish people, visiting your brethren and visiting Palestinian people. Tell us about the person-to-person encounters that you had.
Well, the contrast is kind of amazing about how people are treated. We knew Becca Wolf, who's from Santa Fe and is married to a Palestinian man and lives in Beit Omar with him. He's a Palestinian man who lives in the West Bank. He cannot travel with us to Jerusalem. He cannot travel with us to the beach in Tel Aviv.
Even being married to an American.
Right. As a matter of fact, he can't get a visa to come to the United States to see their child, who's 2 years old. So that's the kind of unequal treatment. Palestinians are divided into four classes. There's the Gazans, who are basically in an outdoor prison, can't go anywhere. There's West Bank Palestinians that can only go to the West Bank but can't even travel freely between the cities because they're checkpoints, and it's very difficult to get, say, from Ramallah to Hebron. There are East Jerusalem Palestinians who are subject to losing their citizenship all their time if they leave Jerusalem for a while, or they're annexed by this wall that is cutting more and more Palestinians off from Jerusalem. And then you have Palestinians in Jerusalem that have some of the rights of Israeli citizens, although not as many rights.
And how does this play out in the days and the lives of people whom you met?
I think, give you an example, in Beit Omar, which is an agricultural village that relies on pears and plums and fruit trees and used to be quite prosperous. They're constantly on the edge about water, whether it's water for their fields or whether it's water to drink. And so they often have to buy water. If you notice, all the Palestinian homes have water tanks because they have to buy water, whereas in Israel, in the settlements, water is plentiful and they have a lot of pressure and they have water 7 days a week. In Palestine, they might have it, or in the Palestinian villages, once or twice a week. If they grow things, they can't take their things to market. They can't get to Jerusalem, where the main market is, because if you're a Palestinian, you can't, and you live in the West Bank, you can't go to Israel. So,
what about feeding each other? Can you get, in other words, can Palestinians feed other Palestinians with the food that they grow?
They can do that, and some, if you're willing to spend 2 or 3 hours and get through the checkpoints, you can actually trade food between some of the Palestinian villages. The problem is, as you said, the population has remained constant, but more and more of their territory has been taken away. In the example I gave, this Indian settlement has been, in some cases, they just cordon off the olive trees that they say are too close to their settlement for their own security. So they don't allow the Palestinians to go there. So I asked the Palestinians, they're yours, do you ever apply? And they say, it's ours. We don't accept a process where we have to ask people to go to cultivate or harvest our own olive trees. So there's a pride among the Palestinians and a desire to stay and a desire to make their life as good as possible.
One of the things that is an ongoing conversation year after year is, what's the solution? Two-state solution, one-state solution. Is it possible to have a two-state solution when there's no Palestinian, so little Palestinian land left?
If you look at land and you look at water, what's left for the Palestinians is not a viable state. It's a group of Bantustans or Cantons. Whatever you feel ideologically you think would be best, there's not enough left to have a Palestinian state. You'd have a group of villages and 2 or 3 cities connected by checkpoints, by walls, all kinds of things that wouldn't be viable at all. And East Jerusalem, which would be the capital, has pretty much been surrounded by settlements, and it's cut off from the West Bank. So I think people, not for ideological reasons, just say there's one country here, and Israel is going to have to choose between either an apartheid state in which half their population has no non-equal rights, or a democracy in which everyone in the state shares the rights.
And they don't want a democracy because what if they're outvoted?
That's the dilemma that they've pretty much put themselves in. They could be outvoted. And I think people like Ali Abenema, who've seemed way out there for a long time, he's proposing a single state, but with the cultural and religious rights of all groups protected. So, and the right to practice your religion, your culture, no one would deny anybody that. And I think if you look at it on the ground, that's the only thing that's possible. There is no Palestinian state left.
Is there an Israeli peace movement that is viable at this point? Did you meet with people?
There are certainly progressive Israelis. There are people who in the past have refused service in the Israeli Defense Force, particularly when they had to serve in the West Bank. There's organizations that support Palestinians. There's an organization that protests against housing demolitions and turns people out when there's a housing demolition order. And I think more recently there's been more civic organizing among the Palestinians. Becca Wolf is going to talk about a women's group, a group of women from leaders from the West Bank who've come together and are organizing women's resistance with the support of Israeli women. And so that's a new development. And then there are community organizations within the West Bank. For example, if somebody's olive trees gets cut down in Beit Amar, the community group goes out and says, we'll build you a greenhouse and we'll help you grow vegetables where you used to on the land that you still have left. Or in Silwan, which is a very crowded community in East Jerusalem, there's a community center. The Israelis just bulldozed the entire larger area, which was a playing area, a play field, and now they set up, there's a room in one house that's a library, there's a room in another house which is a kitchen. They ran a camp for 300 kids moving from house to house because they can't build anything there. Going back to the water, a Palestinian cannot get the right to build a well. There's an Israeli-based group of engineers, of supporters of the Palestinian rights, a civic organization that has actually built solar panels and wind turbines in some of the areas of Bedouin villages, providing them with electricity since they're technically not allowed to build any structures. The Israeli army has come and destroyed these wind turbines and solar panels because they provide, they're a structure. And I think one of the most striking things is we were in a Bedouin village in which the people hardly had electricity. They couldn't build wells. And they're 15 feet from a new settlement that people had. You could look across this fence, and there were big trees, and there were gardens, and there was grass. And the Israelis inside lived a totally different life.
The people who live in settlements are acquainted face-to-face with the reality. The people who live in big cities may not have any idea what's going on, depending on how observant they are or how well the media is covering it. The people who live in settlements, I mean, do they just not care? Do they think these people are less than human? I mean, what's going on psychologically?
Well, there are settlements of different sizes, and there are settlers who are ideological settlers, who are religious settlers, or many just got a good housing deal from the government because they subsidize people who move into these settlements. Some of the large settlements of 50,000 people around Jerusalem, I don't think they think they live in a settlement. It may be 20 years old. There are no Palestinians around. They may not know that it's been built on Palestinian land. Then there are the settlers who go out and throw a trailer down right next to a Palestinian village and then ask for the IDF to come and protect them militarily. They're there for a reason, to encroach on that land, to take over the land. So I guess some people, it is easy if you're in a big settlement near Jerusalem, for example, of which there are many, to sort of ignore the fact that you're on Palestinian land and that you have a fountain in front of your settlement and they barely have enough water to drink. On the other hand, the newspaper Haaretz, which is widely circulated, gives pretty detailed accounts of the mistreatment of the Palestinians. So I'm kind of amazed when people say, I didn't know that was going on. They may not see it right around them, but if they wanted to find out, if they read it, you know, they'd have to know.
We're talking to Jeff Haas. So what, in your view, is Israel's long-term strategy? I mean, you have a country full of a close to equal number of Jews and Palestinians, and I mean, they're not going to go anywhere. So what are they thinking?
I think they can drive them out.
Where do they think they're going to go?
I don't know if they've thought that through. I just think they
hope.
How
can they not have thought that through?
I think that they're marginalizing the Palestinians more and more. Whether they think some other country will accept them, whether they think they'll leave voluntarily, whether they think somehow they'll die off because they can't live without water. It's hard to imagine the long-term play, but it seems like Israel wants all of that land for itself. And the Palestinians that are left are going to live pretty much maybe the way blacks lived in South Africa, in Bantustans, in areas where they have no rights and they have no access to being self-sufficient. It seems to me that's the direction they're going in. We'll create Bantustans, and that's just the way it's going to be. And we'll let Ramallah have free trade, and they'll have some middle class there, and we'll buy off the Palestinian leadership, which they've done quite successfully, and use them to control the population, and we'll let them be rich, and they'll control the Palestinians. That's been the strategy, and it's been totally backed by the U.S. If you read the WikiLeaks, the U.S. was urging the Palestinians to take almost nothing, no water, no real land, take anything Israel has to offer, and they probably would have been successful, except Israel wasn't willing to give up anything. So they really don't see, you know, anything for Palestinians except a few separated large cities that they allow, you know, that they have some civilian control over.
Now, do you see any shift in American public opinion or on the American, on the level of American government, or is it just business as usual? What do you see?
I see among young people, among educated, and among any kind of leftist or progressive people, more and more disenchantment with Israel and more realization of what their plans are.
Both Jewish and Gentile opinion.
Yeah, and in particular Jewish, young Jewish people, I don't think they're not supporting Israel. They don't give unqualified support, and they hardly, you know, in many cases, they support Palestinian rights. So among young people, I see a change. Among churches who are now signing on to this boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, I see a change. The area you don't see a change in is Congress. And Congress, as Jeff Halpert said, as Israel feels, as long as they have this congressional support in which Congress falls all over itself to show who's more pro-Israel, who will support with more weapons and more money Israel policies, as long as they try to outdo each other, then Israel feels secure, basically, and pretty much doing what they want.
Now, how do you feel about this as a Jewish person yourself? I mean, I look at the idea of Israel, and I think, what a lovely thing. I wish, why can't it live up to the beauty of its original ideal?
Well, I think there were two ideals. One certainly was legitimate, was protection for Jews who had been oppressed and prosecuted and murdered throughout Europe. The other was an idea of aggrandizement and of a chosen people that had the right to take over somebody else's land. And there are a lot of people think that that's really been the ideology that was there from the beginning, and some say that's the ideology that has taken over Israel today.
And who thought, for whatever, like, biblical, scriptural reasons, that it was their land in the first place.
That it was their land and they had the right to take it and that they were superior. And it's not it's not an accident that Israel is the savior right now of the right wing. The militarists, the evangelicals, they love Israel because Israel represents the use of military force to expand your land and be a superior force. And that's the way the U.S., unfortunately, that's the way they're seen in the rest of the Middle East. It's sad that it seems like that many Jews, including the leadership of Israel, have learned the wrong lesson from the Holocaust. Not instead of never again for anyone, it's never again for us, so we'll make sure that nothing ever happens to us. And they pull out the Holocaust thing all the time when it really doesn't apply. And I began this discussion about the use of water because you can't justify taking most of the water as a security issue. You can argue the wall, you can argue checkpoints, I don't agree with that, but how do you argue that you get 90% of the water when you're 50% of the population and you get eight times as much water per person as they do?
Jeff, there is a conference coming up in the end of September in Albuquerque.
There is. It's September 28th and 29th at the Presbyterian Church on Carlisle. Wonderful speakers coming, Palestinian women and men, and Ali Abunima and Jeff Halper. And I really urge people to go down to Albuquerque for that conference.
And it's called the Sabil Conference?
Friends of Sabil. Sabil are Palestinian Christians, and they are sponsoring the conference, but it's very broad, and some of the best speakers in the country and from Israel-Palestine will be here to talk.
And the website for that conference is FOSNA, F-O-S-N-A, that's Friends of Sabil North America, FOSNA.org. Jeffrey Haas is a civil rights attorney, author, and human rights advocate, and he will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at 107 West Barcelona here in Santa Fe. And for more information, you can call 469-0714. The talk is going to be Jeff and Becca Wolf doing a talk called Demographic Engineering, Israeli Displacement of Palestinians from East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.